Some local police chiefs are calling for restrictions on assault rifles. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. One of those is Miami Beach Police Chief Daniel Oates. He knows all too well the destructive power of these guns. He was head of the Aurora, Colorado Police Department in 2012 when a shooter murdered 12 people in a movie theater. We'll talk to the chief about how to prevent another school shooting. Also, we'll hear from David Hoggs, a student at Stoneman Douglas. He's become one of the most visible members of the anti-gun violence movement since 17 people were shot to death at his school last week. Then we'll end the day on a high note. The Alvin Ailey Dance Theater is performing this weekend at the Adrian R. Center. We're going to talk to their choreographer, a Miami guy, about the show that he hopes to use to lift up your spirits. That's all coming up next on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, it's been a little more than a week since the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland that left 17 dead. And in that week, a group of students from the school have become household names for their activism against gun violence. Some of these same students have been attacked by right-wing conspiracy groups, which have called them actors and pawns of gun control organizations. Senator Marco Rubio is one of the many prominent people who have come to their defense. He said yesterday on Twitter, quote, "Claiming some of the students on TV after Parkland are actors is the work of a disgusting group of idiots with no sense of decency," end quote. Our next guest has been the focus of some of these harsh attacks, David Hogg. He joins me now. David, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time, because I know you've been extremely busy doing a lot of media lately.
Yeah, I'm basically the press secretary for our campaign at this point, and I just want to say really quick, thank you so much for the hard work you guys do at WLRN and across the nation on NPR. I listen to you guys every morning on my way to school, and you guys do some great work.
Well, I appreciate that, and I will have to admit that as much as I love working here, that these are the stories that I despise having to do. But let's talk about some of the stuff that's happened lately. And I want to start with this. Some of your fellow Douglas students met with President Trump yesterday at the White House. Some met with Governor Scott, and some of them took part in a CNN town hall meeting with a representative of the NRA and both of Florida's senators. Were you able to see any of these?
I was actually able to just barely make it to the town hall on CNN. I had to take three flights that day because I was in Los Angeles on Dr. Phil, and then I had to get back. I had to get on a plane to Atlanta, and then from Atlanta I had to go to Tallahassee. Then from Tallahassee I had to go to Miami. And I eventually made it, but I wasn't able to get on stage because I was late. But yeah, I was able to make it, and I'm really glad because everybody there was speaking so passionately and cared so much about it that I think we really got some of our main points across. But we have so much more of a fight to do because, as you saw last night, many of the people that were there they sidestepped a lot of our questions, and that's not okay, but it's okay. That's why we have elections.
You know, 100 of your fellow students took part in a demonstration in Tallahassee yesterday, but thousands joined them. And around the country, we see thousands of students walking out of school, a number of schools here in South Florida, walkouts yesterday and the day before. Why do you think that the shooting at Douglas has inspired such activism? And we've had mass shootings before, but we haven't seen anything like this.
Because, like, the day of the shooting, I immediately got to my house after making sure my sister and everybody in my family was okay. I went to my house, grabbed my camera, and went over there to start taking B-roll. And as I was there, I saw a few interviewees, and I kind of got an idea, like, hey, I need to tell people that this cannot be the new normal. It was awful because I still haven't even been able to really deal with, like, some of the grieving that I have to deal with from this, because I've been working so hard to make sure that to prevent the deaths of so many other people, you know. As I went there, though, I think really the immediate action and steps that we took to keep this fresh in the media's mind and make them realize that, hey, this is not going to be just another mass shooting is really what happened.
You know, no sooner had your fellow students arrived at the state capitol this week than Republicans rejected a proposal to ban assault rifles. How much of a setback did that feel like when you heard about it?
It was actually a motivating one because it proves just what we're saying, that these NRA members are people that are only listening to the NRA, not listening to the screams of the children of this nation and this nation as a whole. And that sucked, yes. That really was just awful. To see all of our hard work that we'd done over just the less than a week at that point go into that and then refuse to pass it just so showed how evil so many of these lawmakers are, and that they would not even allow a bill to discuss assault weapons. It shows the broken state this country's in, but it offers a motivating force as to why people have to get out and why they have to vote in midterms and why they have to vote in every single election to prevent these evil people from getting in through NRA donations to their campaigns and to prevent them from continuing to, honestly, in my opinion, kill our children, because they aren't taking action. They're only listening to the NRA.
You know what the president had suggested, arming teachers in order to protect students. What do you think of that idea?
I think that's his opinion, and I need to listen to it just as much as he needs to listen to mine, just as much as everybody needs to listen to each other, because this needs to be a discussion, not a debate. Personally, I don't agree with it, because what if you were to get in a scenario where it was like blue on blue, essentially? Like, what if you had a teenager that had a gun because their teacher had been shot, and the teenager was trying to defend himself but got mis-ID'd and was shot, and you can say, hey, we should give all these students IDs so that they can identify between them. These are split-second decisions that these law enforcement officers would have to make in this hypothetical scenario, and they aren't going to have time to look down at an ID. They need to make the decision between whether or not to pull the trigger. And if they believe that that may be a target, they're going to say it is the target and take that person out, regardless of if it actually is, obviously. And that is my main concern. If people have guns in the classroom, what are the odds of students having it used against them and teachers having it used against them? Because these police officers are not going to know who the shooter is. That's the main issue. I would love to prevent the deaths of every other school child in America by implementing these policies. But honestly, I don't think it'll work, especially when even in South Florida, we don't have enough money to pay our teachers essentially what's a living wage. How can we be expected to teach them how to handle a firearm? I don't see that happening, and I don't think the answer to this is more guns.
Again, I'm talking with David Hogg. He's a student at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, and he's a name that you've probably seen around a lot. Because he's been one of those students who has been very outspoken and has been in a lot of interviews on television and on radio and so forth. You know, David, I wanted to ask you personally, do you know anyone who's a member of the NRA, or do you know anyone who owns a gun?
Yes, to all of the above.
Okay. Go ahead.
My father owns a gun as a retired FBI agent. He does.
Okay.
One of the people that I interviewed during the shooting was a junior NRA member that planned on shooting guns for their 18th birthday, which, mind you, was the next day. And this clearly changed that event. And I know that 99.9% of people in the NRA are very good people. They're people that are responsible people that want to take care of their guns and be safe with them. It's the people at the very top of the NRA, like that woman that was up there last night, which, by the way, if she's listening, thank you for coming. But beyond that, she kept mentioning how this is a problem with the lawmakers and how it's the lawmakers this, lawmakers that. She is the people that are buying these lawmakers through her NRA donations to their campaign. The fact that Marco Rubio, which I am also extremely grateful for him coming out and working together with us on, he needs to acknowledge the fact that he got $3.3 million from the NRA in campaign donations. That's $176,000 for each of these 17 students, $176,000 for their lives. And I'm glad he's working with us. We have to work together on this. Now, he needs to acknowledge that, though.
The other thing, too, though, is this, you know, and because I don't have a member of the NRA here to obviously push back or challenge on you, so I'm going to have to do that. But, you know, again, we hear the NRA after a lot of mass shootings will come out and say, but David, they are concerned that there is a push to try to perhaps take all guns away.
Okay. I want to set this straight right now. I want everybody to have their gun that is a mentally stable person, a person that has a clean background and no history of domestic violence. If you are a person that gets all of those and hasn't committed a like felony, a person that has like essentially no criminal record or violent past, hasn't committed acts of domestic violence, you should be able to own whatever gun you want. Because it's the same people are the people that are not causing these atrocities. It's the people that are insane and the policymakers' failure to take action that are resulting in the death of these students. It's not. We are trying to take anyone's gun away that is a responsible gun owner. We are trying to reform it so that people that are irresponsible don't get their guns. In the same way that with the First Amendment, you can't say fire in a crowded theater. In the same way that you can't say that, you shouldn't be able to own a gun if you're a mentally unstable person.
The sheriff of Broward County announced yesterday that there will be deputies armed with AR-15s at schools across the county. Do you think that's going to make you feel safer?
Given the fact that they're law enforcement officers, it will make me feel somewhat safer, but I also am worried about the security risk that I pose to my fellow students. It's just insane that we even have to talk about this. The fact that there are conspiracies about me out there right now, that I'm a 27-year-old from 2035 working for the Clinton administration and have had a facelift and am actually 112 years old. It's insane. I'm a witness to this, and I'm being victimized as such. It's disgusting. And honestly, it's sad that so many people have lost faith in our country, but it's also been a good thing for us. They've helped us out a lot with our voice. The media has kept talking to us as a result from them. My Twitter following has more than tripled ever since they started making these remarks towards me. And it's actually made our cause even stronger because it's given us something to fight against.
And you talk about that. You talk about the fact that some of the most prominent anti-gun violence activists from Douglas have come under personal attack by the far right. And according to the Hamilton dashboard by Russian bots, what do you think about this? What do you think about the fact that you especially have been at the center of these attacks?
Honestly, I think it's disgusting, but at this point, it's just hilarious because these people have clearly never seen me act because I've had to do that in TV production. It's not pretty. I am awful at acting, and I'm a student. Like, the thing that I love most is the conspiracy that I didn't even go to our high school, and somebody posted a photo saying, "Huh, here's proof he went to my high school." And there was a photo of a person wearing the Eagles logo right above me. You know, and then somebody opened up their yearbook and showed the exact page that was, showing how that was false and that I went to Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. I also want to make something clear right now. The reason why I have so much involvement with Southern California is because I grew up there until the middle of freshman year. I moved out here because the cost of living in Southern California was so high that my father was not going to be able to support us with our mother financially out there, so we had to move to South Florida, and we chose Douglas because it's such an amazing school. But we moved out here, and I went back every summer to meet with some of my best friends. That's when I made that recording of the lifeguard that wasn't being a very good person. And that's just part of my instincts to take out my phone and record things that shouldn't be happening, you know.
School starts next Tuesday. Do you feel ready to get back?
Honestly, I don't know. I want to keep working. I want to keep getting these hits out there so people don't forget. I have 3 AP classes, and I have almost all honors that I have to do all this work in. So I don't know how I'm going to handle the work. I don't know how I'm going to handle all of these people that I want and need to speak to make all of our voices heard. But I'm going to have to figure it out, and I will, because when I'm under pressure, I prosper. And that's really part of the reason. And I think that's true of so many students at Douglas, too, and so many young people out there. When we are put under pressure, we are the generation, mind you, of the recession. We're the generation that has grown up with mass shootings. Even since I was born, Columbine happened 19 years ago. I'm 17. We are the generation that has had to live under so much pressure. Now is when we take activism and we say, no, this is not okay. And we use our social media platform to connect immediately and work with each other to take these actions. And that's what we have to do because these politicians won't.
And considering, as you said, you took 3 flights yesterday, you're doing all of this, the funerals, the activism, the national attention, the both positive and negative. And again, you're just a teenager. How are you doing in general?
I've always wanted to work in the news, so I've got an insane taste of what it's like to kind of like be pushed through the news cycle constantly, the 24/7 cycle of news. In fact, this morning was the first hit that I missed. I was supposed to be on New Day with Chris Cuomo, and I woke up to 40 calls around 7 o'clock from his producer and everybody else saying like, "Where are you?" Because I said I could come on, and I honestly got home at 1:30 last night. I was gonna have to get up at 5:30 to get out and do that. I physically, my mind just wouldn't let me get up. I actually woke up to a text from my mom saying, "Where are you? If you don't answer, I'm going to call the police." And because my mom was out like getting groceries and stuff, and running errands so that she didn't really know where I was at the time, but she knew I wasn't responding. And it's that fear that this country is going to have to turn into motivation. It's that fear that we're going to have to say, this is not okay. We don't want to be fearful like this anymore. We shouldn't have to be. And that's what I think is going to happen during midterms. And that's what I think is going to happen at every election from now on. The American citizens are waking up. And this is really the third great awakening in American history, and I love it. I've never felt so American.
David Hogg, again, a student at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. David, thank you so much for the time, and best to you as you try to get back to a normal life next week.
Thank you.
All right. Still to come, we are going to have a conversation with Miami Beach Police Chief Daniel Oates. He's got personal experience with mass shootings. He was in Aurora, Colorado during one of the most notorious mass shootings ever. We're going to talk to him coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, my next guest is Miami Beach Police Chief Daniel Oates. He's all too familiar with mass shootings. He was in charge of the Aurora, Colorado Police Department in 2012 during the Aurora Theater mass shooting. That shooter, who is now serving multiple life sentences, used similar weapons as the alleged shooter at Douglas High School. Chief Oates, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
I want to ask you, I want to go back to the Aurora shooting to understand mass shootings in general. And remind us a little bit about what happened and when you got that call.
Well, it happened at 12:40 in the morning. It was the premiere of one of the Batman movies, a completely crowded theater, 350 people, 1,100 people in the complex. And the shooter fired 65 rounds with an AR-15, 6 rounds with a shotgun, and 5 more rounds with a handgun. He killed 12 people and shot and wounded 58. At the time, it was the largest mass shooting in U.S. history. The perversity of all of this is that today, 5 years ago, that was still a relatively rare occurrence. Today, in terms of wounded and killed, it's been eclipsed by Pulse and Las Vegas. And in terms of frequency, these things are happening more and more frequently.
And, you know, one of the things about that shooting is that your officers arrested him shortly after he had committed this crime. I mean, how did that happen and what was going on at that time?
We captured him after he was done shooting. The only people left in the theater were people who were horribly wounded. Everyone else had gotten out. And he walked out the back of the theater and essentially into the arms of my cops. Unfortunately, in these kinds of events, that is the most common occurrence, is that the shooting is over when the cops arrive. Even though my cops were on the scene within 90 seconds, the confusion of the moment didn't put us in the presence of the bad guy until about the 4.5-minute mark. And by then, the shooting was over.
See, something else that's interesting, too. I mean, look, Aurora is a municipality in the Denver area. And I lived out there many, many years ago. And this is a year after Columbine. I wondered, you know, what did Columbine teach us about mass shootings? This one's special because it's at a school like Stoneman Douglas.
Well, part of the reason that we performed so well in that event and did such a good job was a function of Columbine. I arrived as a new police chief in 2005, so that was 6 years after Columbine. And many of my colleague chiefs in the area had been mid-level or senior-level commanders at Columbine. And the entire law enforcement community in the Denver metro area was deeply scarred by Columbine. They felt that they had been criticized for making poor decisions. And there was a never again sort of attitude about that. And training was at the highest possible level to be aggressively go after active shooters if that kind of event occurred, and then deal with the mitigation, the immediate handling of wounded immediately after the event. So it was a very raw issue for all of law enforcement in Colorado, the Columbine event.
So as the story about Stoneman Douglas is unfolding,
right,
what are you thinking about? I mean, and especially in how everybody is handling it.
Well, I mean, there's two things. One is anyone who goes through this, anybody in the community is a victim. I am a victim of the Aurora Theater event, along with 350,000 residents of Aurora, Colorado. There, of course, are the people who are immediate victims who had families or loved ones who were wounded. But collectively, it is a cataclysmic event on a community. So every time one of these things happens, I end up on the phone that evening with two particular sets of parents who lost loved ones at Aurora, because in the police department, we get to know everybody. You know, we get to know all the families, and we grieve with them. And every time one of these things happens, there's this collective return to anguish and pain that we all go through. And so one of the ways I cope with it is I commiserate with these two particular sets of parents. So it just, the victimization just continues. Then there is the law enforcement piece, and there's always all this reporting on what the cops did, and some of that is going on right now. And I will tell you, frankly, I don't trust any of it. I wait until my colleague professional, till Scott Israel, puts together the presentation that he will eventually put together for all of law enforcement. And several months from now, I'll sit down in an auditorium with other colleagues, and Scott or someone on his staff will present to us what really happened after the forensics and everything else. So, for instance, this guy used an AR-15. Okay, I guarantee you, I don't know anything about the forensics right now, but I guarantee you some rounds penetrated walls because it's such a high-capacity, powerful rifle, and people were struck in, you know, adjoining rooms. That's what happened in Aurora. We had three people struck in the adjoining theater because the rounds went through the wall. So that's the kind of thing that we'll learn, you know, movement of the cops, what they did to mitigate, how they transported and got wounded out of there. Those are all things that as a professional, eventually we all need to hear. And after the Aurora shooting, we probably gave 150 such lectures around the country about our experience.
Again, I'm talking with Miami Beach Police Chief Daniel Oates. And as we're discussing, I mean, he's got experience with mass shootings. He was he was in charge of the Aurora, Colorado Police Department in 2012 during the Aurora Theater mass shooting. So now we hear law enforcement officials talking about these weapons, specifically the AR-15 is an assault rifle. And there's a call for not just from the students at like one of the ones we just heard from earlier, but from law enforcement to put more restrictions, to look at, you know, basically the laws around these kind of guns. Where do you stand on these kind of weapons?
Well, I'll give two thoughts. The first press conference I did after Aurora, I got asked about gun policy. You know, the international media was there, and right away they're asking me, well, the community's grieving. And I remember quietly seething at that, that the place and time to ask a police official about that isn't when these are happening. We should be wrestling with this all the time. I've also said throughout my career there's no place in American society for assault weapons. The only people should have them are should have them as our police officers, this is a legal and cultural fix that the country has to arrive at. All this, everything else is secondary to finding a way to control guns in our society. So I understand Scott Israel said the same thing, or something like that. There's just no place for these weapons in society, and until those who make decisions in our society and control our laws change that, unfortunately, I think this is going to continue to occur.
We heard from the president yesterday. Because we hear, obviously, in a week after the shooting, we're sitting here and trying to figure out, is there a way to end these kind of shootings, especially in schools? How do we make schools safer? So one of the things the president talked about yesterday with families was arming teachers. This is not new. We've heard this before. And Scott Israel's talked about making sure that there is a deputy at every school with an AR-15. Your thoughts on how do we make schools safer?
Well, it'll be terribly sad for our society if we have to start arming teachers. And I think that your earlier guest, Mr. Hogue, said that, expressed that very, very well. However, there is a new bill that's been put before the legislature that or is about to be that we the police chiefs in Florida got a chance to read earlier this week that would empower superintendents to do exactly that. And my reaction at this point was, who am I to tell a superintendent that they shouldn't? You know, I imagine an enlightened superintendent who went down that road would be very, very careful in who got it, what the training was, all of those things. But Mr. Hogue mentioned things like blue-on-blue type confrontation, cops go into school and they don't know who's supposed to have the weapon, all of those things, all those risks go through the roof. We, you know, in law enforcement leadership, we spend a career trying to train cops when to use deadly force and when not to, and our very, very best efforts and extensive training, we still have mistakes. Teachers will never receive the kind of training that our folks receive. Odds are high that the percentage of mistakes will go up.
And you just brought up but the other issue too is this. When you go into a shooter situation, an active shooter situation like this, it's not knowing who is the perpetrator, who are the people you can trust. That's why I'm wondering, you know, why you would think that ever having anybody else armed would be a good idea.
I don't know how you make it work, frankly. But I also continue to see this victimization going on, and if a superintendent of a particular school system wanted to try and make it work, at this point, who am I to say that they shouldn't? We can't seem to stop these shootings through all the means that we've tried. This sounds like this was a school as on top of this issue as could be, and we still have 17 dead at that school.
There's also a conversation about making it so that no one under 21 could buy these kind of weapons. Your thoughts?
I think that's a no-brainer. I think that's actually something that's ridiculously easy for state legislatures and the Congress to pass. That just makes complete common sense, and it's hard to believe that the NRA is going to fight that one.
When you look at what's happened, this was, again, Broward County. This is our neighbor just to the north. Do you think about, you know, the schools within your district? And do you think that we are prepared to try to prevent that? Or are you worried that, no, everybody's susceptible? We're open to another attack like this.
I think we're as reasonably prepared as we can be to respond. In terms of how we target hardened schools today, I think Marjorie Stoneman Douglas was as reasonably target-hardened as it could be, and again, we still have 17 victims. The only real way to do better would be to put more cops in the schools, and that is staggeringly expensive as someone who's run police department budgets for 16 years.
What other measures do you think we could take, whether it's on the local level, the state level, that we could make schools safer, make a campus safer?
Well, I've suggested to my colleague chiefs that perhaps we could change the law so that there are circumstances where we take guns away from people because of aberrant behavior and then have to return the guns later because there's no judicial determination that we can keep the guns because there's a presumption that the guns should be returned. Perhaps we could pass some statute that shifts that burden of proof, that if a street officer takes a gun from someone under circumstances that are troubling and we take it for safekeeping for a period of time, that at that point, that person, if they want the gun back, has to go into court and affirmatively prove that they are a responsible gun owner who can take care of that weapon. And we, the authority that took the gun away, would have a chance to be heard through our attorneys in some sort of hearing. That's the only new idea I have. I really believe that this is a much, much bigger issue about access to guns across the country
Do you think the gun buybacks or amnesties work?
I think they make us feel good and they have some marginal impact. You know, any gun that is off the street is not a gun that will be used in a crime of passion or available to be for planning a robbery and those kinds of things. But we have something like 300 million guns out in American society. And if we do a gun buyback and during the course of a day we buy back 50, I'm not sure we're really accomplishing much.
One of the other things, too, that's popped up, and this is just one of the strange moments here, is that I believe Stoneman Douglas High School had recently gone through one of these active shooter trainings, drills. And I know Miami-Dade County had also been going through some as well. What do you know about these drills and their effectiveness?
Well, again, my experience in the three cities I've worked as a police chief is that the school systems are very enlightened about how to tell kids to target harden in place, shelter in a classroom, and those kinds of things, and they're doing that which is reasonable and smart. Our drills, when we drill in the schools, it's usually around movement. We usually practice in an empty school and try and anticipate what we would deal with, and we train in that regard, and again, enlighten police departments do actual training in the schools within their jurisdiction when they can. So everybody's doing their best. I don't think any of us should go down the road of saying, oh, this wouldn't have happened if Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School had done things better. It sounds like they did things reasonably well, giving all the burdens and pressures on a school system at any one time.
And I know not so much with schools, but I know that in just even in office situations, dealing with adults and training, shooter training, it's either run, hide, or even fight.
Correct.
Do you think that we should ever teach kids run to the fight, run to the danger?
No, we should teach kids to run away if possible, hide if they can't run, and fight if they have to. That's essentially the smart way of doing things. By the way, years ago, the Houston Police Department did an excellent video on this. It's about 8 minutes long. It's great for work training in any setting. You can still find it on the internet, and I'm sure there's other ones that have been done since. It's called Run, Hide, Fight, but it's an excellent training piece.
Again, I've been talking with Miami Beach Police Chief Daniel Oates, talking about the issue of mass shootings, protecting our schools, and what should we do on the issue of assault rifles. Chief Oates, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, we're going to try to step away from this story a little bit, and coming up next, we're going to go to the stage with a Miami dancer who's now the choreographer for the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater, something I promise to lift your spirits. That's all coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Well, it's really been an awful week in South Florida, and one of the ways that we can express our pain is through the arts. Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater begins its run in Miami tonight. That's at the Adrian Arts Center. Of course, they couldn't have known ahead of time what we've been dealing with here, but the company is bringing a dance for troubled times. One of Ailey's longtime dancers, Jamar Roberts, grew up here in Miami. And now he's choreographed a dance for the company. It's called Members Don't Get Weary. He says it was partly in response to his feelings that the world is not in a very good state right now. The dance is set to the music of John Coltrane, and Robert says with that, he wanted to encourage goodness in people and also action. Here's his conversation with WLRN's Alicia Zuckerman.
I know you grew up in Ghouls for a while. Mm-hmm. And then where did you first study dance?
Gosh, I think I first studied in Jacksonville, Florida, actually. It was the year after Hurricane Andrew, because after that hurricane, my family moved to Jacksonville for like a year, and that's where I was introduced to dance. It wasn't formal training. It was very informal. We were doing, you know, dancing to Mariah Carey in tutus and tights and ballet shoes, but that's where it started.
Oh, so because your family lost their home in Hurricane Andrew,
yeah.
Right? How did you discover dance?
There was a neighbor. Her name was Kathleen Daniels. I have no clue where she is right now. Facebook hasn't even helped me find her. But
maybe WLRN will.
Maybe. She basically invited me to an after-school rehearsal of like a very recreational dance group that was happening after school, because they needed guys to like partner the girls. And we lived right down the street, so it wasn't a hassle to get there at all. Since it was informal, you could do it in sweatpants and a t-shirt, you know, so I just started doing that, basically helping out a friend, and then it just went on and on and on ever since.
That's for sure. How old were you?
I was probably 10, I think, at the time, 10 or 11.
What about the first time you saw the company, Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater? What do you remember about that?
I remember the section in Revelations called Center Man in particular.
Where was it? Where did you see that?
I think it was at the a theater in Broward, Fort Lauderdale. And I went there with my dance teacher at the time, who's still I call her my dance teacher now, but she's no longer. We're really good friends.
And Angel Fraser Logan,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And so, yeah, I remember seeing Center Man in particular, and I was just blown away by the entire performance. And apparently I cried. I don't remember crying, but apparently I cried. And I said, that's what I want to do.
What was it? I know you said you don't remember crying, but you presumably remember being really moved by it.
Yes.
Do you remember what it was about that?
I think it was just the power and the energy of just three men sort of dancing. That's all they were doing. They didn't have anything else but their bodies, you know. And I just remember being really floored by like the tension that was being created on the stage at that moment.
How old were you then?
Gosh, I was probably at this point maybe 13, 14, something like that.
And so you were already studying dance?
Yeah, I was studying at that time.
And where were you studying?
Probably at Coral Reef Senior High School, either a freshman or sophomore, and I would go to Dance Empire, where Angel taught classes, after school.
Do you remember that it occurred to you in that moment at that performance that, like, that's what you could do and that's what you wanted to do?
For a moment, and then it went away because I guess that's how kids are. They're obsessed about a thing, and then you're not engaged in that thing anymore, and then you kind of forget it and you move on. So no, it was not in that very moment that I wanted to be a dancer. I think I wanted some part of that experience, but I didn't call it right there on the spot. That actually didn't come until very later.
Yeah, when did that come back?
I think I was pretty... I was like in the company already, actually. I was probably like...
You were in the company when you decided you wanted to be in the company?
Yeah, I was probably like 3 or 4 years in. And I was like, okay, I'll do this.
Wow. Yeah. So, yeah, what do you... Like, do you have any idea what that's about?
Yeah, I think it takes... Well, it took me time to figure out how I was supposed to sort of navigate myself within that space, because I came from a type of dancing that was very free. You know, Angel taught like lots of creative movement, and like she would ask us to improv sometimes. And then coming to Ailey, I stepped into a space very young. I was 18 years old when I got there, where there's all this formality. You know, there's a Lester Horton technique that's involved that I've never heard of. There's a Graham technique that I've studied at school, but it's school. Who takes anything seriously at school?
And was that at New World where you studied?
Yeah, that was at New World. You know, all of these sort of codes surrounding dance and how you perform and what's expected of you as a performer, as a student, and as an artist. And I think it just took me a really long time to wrap my head around what that was and if I wanted to commit to it or not. You know, I mean, you can be in something and be fully 100% uncommitted. You know what I mean? And it's not until you make that commitment that you actually, you know, you're in all the way. So
do you remember, was there like a moment, or did it just sort of happen gradually where you were like, okay, I'm in this?
There was a moment. There was, I got into the company when I was 18. 2 years after that, I left because I was feeling very unsettled and anxious and felt like I'm also a visual artist. I wanted to go and like try out fashion design and a bunch of other different things. So I was feeling really restless. And so I left. And I think it was when I came back. And I think when I came back, I sort of like came back with a different frame of mind, different approach to how I wanted to engage with the company.
So this piece, it's called Members Don't Get Weary. Why John Coltrane? Why did you decide to set this dance to the music of John Coltrane?
Various different reasons. One of them being that there wasn't a piece in the rep that used his music at all. And I was just kind of like, how is that possible? Because he's so iconic. Another reason was because I wanted to use the jazz language, the jazz vernacular, the sound that is so inherent to the African-American culture and tradition. Another reason is because the music is really complicated, and I wanted that challenge of sort of like digging in there and trying to understand it, and then also seeing how I can use that to communicate my ideas through dance and through the dancing body. How can I like tether these sounds as close to dance moves as I possibly can so that they become like a meshed. And so the dance is the music, and the music is the dance. And so the message is coming out in two ways, you know, through the music and also through the body and the choreography.
Well, the name of the piece is Olé. It's from the album Olé, the John Coltrane piece.
Yeah. Coltrane also wanted to be a force of good with his music. He really wanted to, like, spread this, like, message of, like, the good in humanity, because there's good and there's evil. And he wanted to be, like, this pervasive, like, goodness, which I thought would be really helpful in the times that we're living in right now. So when you listen to the music, it has this feeling of heroicism and of I don't know, to me it gets really big and it's very expansive, and it has this feeling of being beyond. And also the word Olé, I've heard a myth about this word Olé. It comes from Allah, meaning God, and I guess the African American tradition and their relationship to the church and to God. And I just wanted to like make that whole connection. But there's tons of reasons for why I chose the music. I'm just going to give you a few because we have limited time.
Yeah, well, I mean, from my perspective, you can't go wrong with using John Coltrane. Although I do imagine it as a challenge and using it to make a dance on. What did you see in your head as you were listening to the music? I mean, I imagine you first sat with the music and started to build the dance around that. Is that how it happened?
Yeah, that's true. I sat with the music for about a year, probably more than a year. What I saw in my head sort of developed over time. Once you get to know every single sound that's about to happen, I could sing that song for you right now from front to back.
That would be impressive.
Then I think you're sort of free of trying to figure out the music, and you're able to use your imagination to color that music with dance steps. And so,
what was the reaction from the dancers when you brought this music?
I remember the first reaction from my assistant. She was helping me translate the steps to the dancers. She said, because I would send her video clips of, you know, these different dance phrases that I wanted her to learn, and she said, I couldn't hear any music. She said all I heard was sound. And I think that was very similar to what the dancers experienced. So when I taught it to them, I would teach them the dance steps without music. And they're learning these steps, but they had not learned the music. I would give it to them with a rhythm or with counts like bum, 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 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But then when the music came on, every count, every rhythm went out the window, and all they had were steps and like this big sound. So I think that they were really shocked and stressed. It was just like, where do I start rhythm wise? But
and it's like, I mean, that music was written like 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's not, it's funny to, you know, to think of it as still having that kind of shock value, really.
Yeah. And also, I don't even, when you think about the type of music that we listen to today on a regular basis and on a radio, it makes sense that, you know, they would struggle to like find where the beat is, because the beats now and everything are so prevalent. Like, you turn the music on and you get your boom, 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 boom. You know what I mean? It's very easy.
The title of the piece, Members Don't Get Weary, where does that come from?
The title came from the title of an album by Max Roach.
Another great jazz drummer in this case.
Yeah, that was. I think this album was also released in the mid, late 60s. And there's a track called Members Don't Get Weary, which was actually an old Negro spiritual from back in the day that he decided to sort of put into the album. And my lighting designer, Brandon Baker, he sort of like delved into jazz and sort of found this record. And he was like, I think this would be a great title. And I said, oh my gosh, he's right.
Why was he right?
Well, because I think the piece had to do, it deals with the blues, and it deals with, you know, it's my sort of response or feeling surrounding how I feel about the state of the world today.
Which is how?
I feel that it is bad. I feel that things are a little displaced and kind of chaotic. And so I wanted to tackle those types of things. But I also wanted to say that this piece is only to encourage and to be hopeful for the future. And so,
since Members Don't Get Weary was the name of an old Negro spiritual, and Alvin Ailey's most famous piece, Revelations, the piece that you said first inspired you, mm-hmm. Is set to spirituals. Do you see this piece as a continuation in a way? And I don't mean continuation of Revelations, but I mean a continuation of that tradition, of the Ailey tradition.
Yes, I do feel that this piece is a continuation of his legacy. It was very purposeful.
You're also a dancer with the company with Alvin Ailey. Yeah. You're a beautiful dancer to watch.
Thank you.
It's really incredible. But this is the first piece that you've choreographed for the company. How has making this dance been different than performing dance?
Well, my first thought was to say that I enjoy it more. I enjoy making dance more than I perform dance, but that's not entirely true. I think that when I make dance, I am more... This is going to sound really hippy-dippy, but when I make dance, I feel like I'm more solid and that I'm more in the world But when I perform, I feel like there is a space and time where I am here. Maybe when the curtain goes up and I realize that the audience is there. But then once the piece starts, I kind of like go away. I don't want to use out of body because you totally got to be in your body to do the thing. But it's I almost feel like I have less control. And with making dance, I have more control. And I like control. I love making dances. I would make dance for free if I had to. You know what I mean? I get the feeling that a lot of choreographers find it very tormenting in a way. And I think there are very stressful moments about it. But essentially, the act of stringing steps along in order to communicate an idea, I think, is a lot of fun. It feels more fun to me.
Do you remember the first dance you made, like even as a kid, like the first dance that you made?
The first dance that I remember that I made was to the Aladdin soundtrack. Like in the beginning of the soundtrack, there are like the songs that you can sing, the ones that have lyrics that are sung by the characters. But towards the end, the middle-ish, towards the end of the album, you get all these instrumentals. And I remember, I think it was called like Marketplace or something like that. It had all these like Arabic sounding like rhythms and like chimes and like bells, but it was to the Aladdin soundtrack for sure. There were no other dancers. It was just me.
And how old were you?
I don't know, but it was on like kitchen floor. I don't really remember.
We've been talking for like, I don't know, 20 minutes or so now. And I know that you didn't talk much growing up. You were,
it was pretty quiet.
Yeah. You were a quiet kid from what I understand. I'm curious, how did you find your voice?
Probably being in the company. I mean, and being a dancer, I think, and sort of learning what that meant over time and what my responsibilities were as an artist. You know, we're not just these vapid beings. I don't know, I had a lot of... not in the beginning, but I found a lot of mentors for myself, like Baldwin, like Toni Morrison, like John Coltrane. And when you read about the lives of these people and the work that they did and how they felt about the work, it rubs off on you. You start to understand that your work is sort of bigger than you. And if you want people to know that, you kind of have to speak up in some way, whether it be through dance or choreography, or if you audibly, you know, say the words. But I think I kind of found my voice in that way. I must have felt that I was lacking some type of tribe because I was so quiet. I didn't really have like a lot of friends, or like I wasn't really popular in the traditional sense. So I felt like I was lacking people that like-minded people, and I had to find out who they were. Like, where are they in the world? Like, who's having the same conversations that I'm having, you know, in my mind that no one ever hears? And I eventually found them, and I they became role models for me. So,
well, congratulations on your first piece that you've choreographed for Alvinelli American Dance Theater.
Thank you.
Jamar Roberts, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And again, that was Jamar Roberts from Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater speaking with WLRN's Alicia Zuckerman. The company performs tonight through Sunday at the Adrian Arts Center in Miami. The Jamar Roberts Dance Members Don't Get Weary runs tonight and Saturday afternoon. You can see a video from that dance, and you can also see Jamar Roberts dancing at WLRN.org. Well, that's the program for this week. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.